Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masterson. Today we'll examine a number of subjects and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and look into why Libya is not our fight with Edward Luttwak, who has served as a consultant to the Office of Secretary of Defense, the National Security Council, and the U.S. Department of State and branches of the military. Then we will speak with one of the GE3 nuclear engineers who blew the whistle on GE in 1975 about design deficiencies on the boiling water Mark I reactor, the same one that has been melting down in Japan. Dale Breidenbau joins us. Then finally, we'll talk with Jeff Farmer, the chief organizer of the Teamsters Union, who visits us in the studio to talk about a revival in support for unions following the union bashing in Wisconsin and a major demonstration in downtown L.A. taking place on Saturday. Joining me now is Edward Luttwak, who is a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He has served as a consultant to the Office of the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Council, the U.S. Department of State, and branches of the military. He is the author of Strategy, The Logic of War and Peace. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edward Luttwak.
Hello.
And you had an article this week in the Los Angeles Times, Libya is not our fight. And I remember you being quite prescient about the Iraq war. You had objections to that intervention based upon the notion that we were taking out a secular leader and this would ultimately lead to a fundamentalist takeover of Iraq. And I think the picture, unfortunately, is pretty much that way. And as much as it looks like Iran was the winner of the Iraq war, who do you think is going to be the winner of this war?
Well, I noticed that the demonstrations in Benghazi, the women were segregated from the men, and each and every one of them had a headscarf, and they were not allowed to march with the men. So I presume that whoever organized that particular demonstration that I happened to see has views about the future of Libya. And, not happy. But that's not the reason for my objection. The reason for my objection is that the war is, after all, not an easy thing. And we have a Secretary of Defense. His name is Mr. Gates. And he consulted his officials, and he told President Obama that the United States should stay out of the Libyan affair. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the Joint Chiefs get together. They know something about war, too, and they said the United States should stay out. And then three people who are not experts in war, Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, Susan Rice, Ambassador to the UN, and Samantha Powers of the National Security Council, very fine ladies, all the three ladies went to Obama and persuaded this most easily persuadable president to, yes, we'd get involved. Phase two was the meeting in Paris, where the French agreed to coordinate. Having agreed to coordinate, they then launched an air attack without coordination ahead of the agreed missile strike against the surface air missiles to open the way to air attacks. The next thing that happens is that having got the UN resolution that talks only about protecting civilians, we have the British and the French talking about removing Gaddafi, which is not included in the resolution. So in this welter of things, with the British, the French, and the three terrible women, all of them impinging on this, the Pentagon has fallen back on its Stalingrad fortress, which is no ground troops, and B, no U.S. command for this bloody mess. Because it is a bloody mess to have no troops on the ground, and yet the objective of removing Gaddafi. And, and the particular problem here is that we are not removing the far worse dictatorship of Bashar Assad in Syria. We are actively supporting the Khalifa family as it imposes its will on the majority of the population in Bahrain. And of course, we have done nothing about Yemen.
But I assume, Edward Luttwak, that one of the arguments that Hillary Clinton and the other two women had was that if the United States does not intervene when a dictator is killing his people using modern military equipment against his own civilian populations, that will give Bashar al-Assad and these other dictators a green light. Do you think that was an argument that was proffered?
That is a perfectly strong, it is a perfectly good argument. And it is, however, based on a premise, and the premise is that the United States of America and the citizens of the United States of America and the taxpayers of the United States of America are responsible for the welfare of the Arab world and not the Arab League, which has hundreds of combat aircraft and, you know, at least 200,000 or 300,000 supposedly well-trained troops, and which in Egypt, member of Arab League Egypt, has the air bases right next door. And in Tunisia, indeed, also member of the Arab League, also has air bases next door. So, yes, somebody should do something about it. But Arab League, having got itself together, all these nice, porky, fatty guys in their white robes and the rest of them, deciding that we have somebody should help the Arabs of Libya, why not them?
Because, well, I suppose,
you know, if we're going to assume humanitarian responsibility, why don't we start in the Congo, where every day 1,000, perhaps hundreds of people get killed every day, much more than in Libya. So on humanitarian grounds, Libya is way down the list.
Well, arguably, the Egyptian military is pretty much in de facto control of the country and somewhat preoccupied.
Preoccupied, but I don't believe they're using the Egyptian Air Force at this time with their F-16s, which, you know, they have a completely idle Air Force. So why does an F-15, a U.S. Air Force F-15, have to fly out from Laken Heath Base in England and fly right across Europe in order to operate over Libya and, by the way, fall out of the sky because of mechanical defect, when we have brand-new, nice F-16s next door in Egypt that could intervene without a perilous flight all the way across Western Europe? Why?
Well, might I suggest a certain hypocrisy on the part of these leaders that they're actually happy to have the U.S. do this?
Because they've already come out, half of them condemning the United States for having bombed Libya.
But nobody likes Gaddafi,
yes, because,
right?
You know, the resolution said that these infidels should go and protect the Arabs of Libya, but they are not allowed to bomb Libya. So, and they're not allowed to attack the surface-to-air missiles and the air defense radar. Their thinking, of course, was that this way the Western air forces would fly over Libya, protect the civilians of Libya, and if one or two got shot down by surface-to-air missiles, a couple of infidel pilots died, so much the better. Anyway, this is nonsense. What happened is that President Obama was given an opinion by his civilian and his military advisors from the Defense Department. The advice was stay out, and then the three terrible women bounced him off that decision. Evidently, he's easily persuaded, and that is how we're involved. But right now, the problem is that unless Mr. Gaddafi decides to resign dedicate himself to poetry or fashion or something, then he will be in Tripoli and he won't be removed without a grand operation. And so we will see whether Mr. Sarkozy's enthusiasm extends that far.
But do you think, though, that the unstated subtext here is the removal of Gaddafi? Because that's the only thing that makes sense strategically.
Yes, yeah, you're quite right. And that is why, since there was no intention to invade one more Muslim country in order to change its government on the part of the Defense Department, that's why they were against intervention. And now they've been forced to intervene, but they said only the air operation, only to open the way for the others, and no troops on the ground. This is a line of defense. When you give good advice, your good advice gets rolled by fast-talking people, then you have to fall back on some minimum, and that's the minimum. And, you know, I don't know what's going on here. Perhaps the three ladies are jealous of Mr. Muammar Gaddafi's sense of fashion and the fact that he changes his clothes every time he appears. And so originally, designs them himself, by the way. I don't know what's going on here, but, you know, we have two wars underway. We have an Iraq situation. And in Afghanistan, as you know, we're trying to reconstruct Afghanistan and turn it into something like Sweden and so on. We're spending approximately $7,000 million a month in Afghanistan. $7,000 million a month in Afghanistan. Now, already, we're spending hundreds of millions in Libya. What's the justification for it?
Well, I imagine the justification to going to the three ladies that you referenced, Edward Luttwak, is that all three, I believe, were haunted by what happened in Rwanda, Susan Rice being in the National Security Council at the time, Hillary Clinton being married to the president, who apparently this President Clinton's greatest regret is that he didn't intervene in Rwanda, and Samantha Power, of course, has written a book about genocide. So
that is very appropriate, and I share that. Because in Rwanda, a battalion of European troops, one battalion, would have stopped the massacre of 700,000. You know, if we are being humanitarian, let's count numbers. In Rwanda, there was a genocide that could have been stopped by introducing one battalion of troops. The moment you put in one European or American battalion, that's when the whole thing would have stopped. And that was not done. Something very easy, very fast, very cheap, very unrisky, very unweighted and unfreighted by Muslim stories and Islam and so on, was not done. So now we do this thing. But what are we going to do about Syria? Because just in the last week, the Bashar Assad dictatorship, which, by the way, has allowed no growth in Syria, unlike Mubarak in Egypt, because they steal everything, absolutely everything. The Bashar Assad dictatorship, A, they arrested 14, 15-year-old boys for writing the word, the dirty word, freedom, huria in Arabic, huria on the walls, freedom. They arrested them. Then when the parents came to demand the release, they shot at them. Then when they had the funeral, they shot at the funeral. Okay? So that's the Bashar Assad government. If we want to, if humanitarian, our reasons are humanitarian, then let's go and immediately invade Syria. Much worse situation than Libya. Far worse.
Well, don't you think, though, Edward Luttwak, that ever since the Cold War, there has been, if you count the wars that we've had since the end of the Cold War, starting with President Bush Sr.'s intervention in Panama to arrest one criminal leader, Noriega, and there was some collateral damage of Panamanian citizens. Then Bush Sr. Had a war with a broad coalition against Saddam Hussein to remove him from Kuwait. Again, armies of the world arrayed against one criminal. Clinton had the same problem with the criminal Milosevic. I don't understand why it is that we can't come up with a mechanism that can arrest these criminal heads of states hiding behind sovereignty.
Yeah, excuse me, you are taking it as your starting point is that we must intervene. You're looking for a cheaper way to intervene.
No, I'm not. I don't believe that the U.S. should be the policeman, but I think if we have a thing called the International Criminal Court that's already preparing indictments against Libya.
International Criminal Court. They are the ones we should send the 82nd Airborne to The Hague, Holland, arrest the International Criminal Court judges and lawyers, arrest them and lock them up for life. Because what they've done so far is that even in open and shut cases, like Charles Taylor case in Liberia, where he ate people and the rest of it, they managed to drag it out on Milosevic for years while running up $1 million bills. And they drag it on for years, like the Arusha court for the Rwanda massacre goes on 7 years, 9 years, while they all charge thousands of dollars at the expense, ultimately, of the U.S. taxpayer, as well as the other countries contributing. And they have done nothing. Remember, the Milosevic trial was 3 years, and then he died before it was concluded. This international court has become a sovereign mechanism for fat lawyers to get fatter. They have absolutely failed. To this day, they have not convicted Charles Taylor, whose crimes were blatant. When he was dictator of Liberia, you may remember, in addition to murdering people, robbing people, mutilating people, and doing so blatantly and openly, and still the trial goes on and on and on as these lawyers charge their $1,500 a day and ask for continuances and so on. So please do not invoke the International Court of Justice.
I wasn't invoking it. I was suggesting that there is a need for a mechanism, given the fact that the ICC is apparently going to indict Gaddafi, and they've already indicted Bashir.
These indictments and these trials are a farce.
Exactly, because they
why does it take years to try Mr. Charles Taylor, who for all his sins and evils did them all in public up front with thousands of witnesses?
Right.
The, you know, looking at the Milosevic trial that lasted for years again with huge bills run up, or the Arusha trial where some Rwandan, hapless Rwandan teenager, they managed to drag out that trial for 7 years. Looking at that process, I would say that if Adolf Hitler were tried by the International Court of Justice at The Hague and its expensive lawyers, I believe the trial would last 30 years.
Well, clearly there's no defense for the ICC.
Yeah, there is no defense. Is no mechanism.
I mentioned the Bashir being the head of state in Sudan. I'm asking you whether there is any way for a mechanism that is...
I'm afraid not. Remember, Bashir of Sudan, the president of Sudan, is the one who was received by the NATO member called Turkey, because Turkey is still a member of NATO, received and embraced by Prime Minister Erdogan and President Gül, who then said that he must be innocent because Muslims do not commit massacres. That's what he said about Sudan. Okay? So let us realize what the situation is. The International Court of Justice doesn't work. This type of pretenses and hypocrisies, and the answer is stay out. Stay out.
And the, and that means people are going to be massacred wholesale from Cote d'Ivoire.
People are going to be
Congo.
I'm afraid that whenever there is a real one, you see, they always talk about this. They always say, "Oh, what about massacre and genocide?" Whenever there's a real one, whether it's the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia or the Rwanda massacre, or back then the Holocaust, or before that the Armenian one, whenever there is a true genocide and massacre, miraculously nobody intervenes. These interventions always take place when there is a relatively handful of people who are being killed by somebody who happens to be unpopular. And in the case of Muammar Gaddafi, no doubt because of his extravagant clothes, which evoked the jealousy of the three ladies. I mean, I can't think of any other reason. Please count up the number of people been killed by Gaddafi since he assumed his dictatorship 40 years ago. They're a tiny fraction of the ones killed by the Assad dictator in Syria. So if we are humanitarian, we have to pay attention to this. How come nobody talks about intervening in Congo, where hundreds of women get raped every day? If we are humanitarians, why? Is it because they're Africans, because they're blacks, they don't count? Only Arabs count?
Well,
what's this? I mean, if we are humanitarian, let us focus our interventions in Africa, where real numbers of people are getting killed.
Well, I would be in favor of that. I mean,
you'll be in favor of that. Good. So let us mount our operation in the Congo.
No, not the United States.
Instead
I think
of saving dozens or...
No, I think
we have here created absurd presumptions. There was already a few days ago somebody in Benghazi, a self-appointed leader or rather, already started being rather truculent and saying, "Well, you know, if the Americans don't intervene, we will have to. We'll take care of them. You know, when we come to power, we're going to punish them and so on." You know, as if we're entitled. Anybody who dirties up his house can call you to clean it up. You know, people are supposed to fight for their own freedom. Let them do it. If there is a real genocide like Rwanda, yes, by all means. But somehow, miraculously, it never happens. When really big numbers of people getting killed, there's always a wonderful reason why we can't do anything.
So you have no hope in the sense that we're living in a more transparent world, that there is any power of moral suasion?
What do you mean transparent world? When the Arab League gets together, all these buffoons and dictators and fat kings get together, and they call on the world to intervene and help the Libyan population, when they themselves have the air bases next door and the aircraft and the troops, what's this? What's happened here is a presumption that somebody else, a.k.a. the United States, has to do the work. Why?
Well,
we have to break this presumption. I regard the Libyan intervention as a tragic because it was the opportunity to stop this madness.
Well, but that would mean that the Gaddafi madness would continue.
And as I say, his continuation is not as egregious as the continuation of the Assad dictatorship of Syria. Well, you know, just because these television pretty faces are filming from Libya and not filming from Syria, it doesn't mean that the nobody goes to the Congo, by the way. They don't go to the Congo for some reason. Some hundreds of women get raped, thousands of people get killed, but the pretty faces of our television networks don't go there. As I say, you know, if somebody says that the Africans are black and therefore don't count, I mean, that's an argument. It's a racist argument, but it's, at least it's an argument. As of now, there is no argument. Well, I don't know what Samantha Powers and Susan Rice and Hillary Clinton argument would be of why we have to save the human beings of Libya and not the human beings of the Congo. Perhaps they'll say that they're blacks and don't count. So let them say it.
Well, Edward Litvak, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Again, I've been speaking with Edward Litvak, who is a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's the author of Strategy, The Logic of War and Peace, and he had an article this week in the Los Angeles Times, Libya, It's Not Our Fight. We'll take a brief station break and we'll be back with one of the GE3 designers who blew the whistle on the faulty reactors that are melting down in Japan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters and this is Background Briefing, and I'm now speaking with Dale Bridenbaugh, who was one of the GE3. He, Gregory Miner, and Richard Hubbard were nuclear engineers at General Electric, who in 1976 blew the whistle on U.S. nuclear power plants. Dale Bridenbaugh and his colleagues resigned from their positions at General Electric and joined the anti-nuclear movement. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dale Bridenbaugh.
Well, thanks, Ian.
And one of the reasons I take it you resigned from GE back in 1976 was over the boiling water Mark I reactor, the very same reactors, four of which are in various stages of meltdown and distress in Japan.
Oh, that's correct. In 1976 and a little bit earlier than that, I had been named to head up the project to reevaluate the safety of the Mark I containment systems. And ultimately, I became disenchanted with the way the program was being run and with other issues. And so my two colleagues and I decided to resign.
And the containment system, I take it, was pretty much on the cheap, wasn't it? Wasn't this meant to be a exportable item that wasn't as expensive as the other ones on the market? And did they cut corners in terms of the strength of the containment vessel?
Well, I wouldn't say they knowingly cut corners, Ian. I think they rushed the design, and one of the features of the Mark I containment, which utilizes pressure suppression, which enables the containment to be designed and sized so that it is smaller in volume than some of the competing designs were. And that feature allowed it to be built in a less expensive way, and also it was supposed to help make the construction time frame shorter, yes.
But is it therefore, what about the age tests? Because the ones, I think the Fukushima number one was about to be retired within weeks, or maybe it was number two. And what kind of tests were done for the longevity? Because one of the concerns is that that this design is an old design and these plants are very old.
To the best of my knowledge, there were no tests done back in the design initial design phase to determine age. They were designed and licensed supposedly to operate for either 20 or 30 years, 35 years perhaps. Different Mark I plants had different operating life periods, but they were all from 25 to 30 years.
Well, the one up in Vermont, Dale, the Yankee plant in Vermont has just been relicensed, and it's past those dates.
That's right. Almost all the nearly all of the Mark I plants, at least in the United States, have reached or are approaching their end of license life. And it's a fairly common practice for the utilities to file applications to extend the operating life by some 10 or 15 years. It's my understanding that Fukushima 1, which went into service in 1971, so it's 40 years old now, was being reviewed by the Japanese regulatory authorities for license extension. I don't know whether that was completed or not, but obviously it's not going to happen now.
Again, I'm speaking with former General Electric engineer and whistleblower Dale Breidenbaugh. Can you just give our audience in layman's terms, Dale, some of the reasons you quit GE over the design of this boiling water Mark I reactor that has several which have melted down in Japan and I think 23 of which still remain in operation here in the United States. What are your principal concerns about this design?
My principal concern back in 1976, and it was not only my principal concern, or not only my concern, but it was concern of General Electric and of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the utilities owning those plants, was that it became knowledge in 1975, approximately, that the primary containment, the Mark I containment, had not been designed to accommodate all of the loads, the pressures, the forces that might be exerted upon it in the event of a major accident. And so it was necessary to mount a very expensive and extensive program to try and determine what those forces could be. It's not something that you can really test for, but it is something that has to be designed for. And that was the program that I was managing when I resigned from GE. At that time, the program was perhaps a third of the way through. The 16 plants that were in operation in the United States at that time were still operating under the basis that it would be a low probability event that anything would go wrong, and it would not be good for the industry if they had to shut them down to finish the analysis. And I was concerned about that. There were other issues, of course, that affected the nuclear program at that time. Not the least of which was the fact that there was no closure of the loop in terms of what to do with the high-level waste, the discharged spent fuel. And we see that airing its ugly head right now in Japan, where the units there are storing in their spent fuel storage pool more spent discharge fuel than they was originally intended. And with the Mark I containment, that pool is up at the reactor level and has been a lot of problems in this last 2 weeks at Fukushima.
And of course, the tragic fact of the matter is, Dale Breidenbaugh, that there's so much more fissile material in the spent fuel pools, and it's of a much more dangerous characteristic, I believe, than the fuel rods themselves inside the computer, nuclear reactors themselves that are melting down.
Well, that has turned out to be the case at Fukushima. It's sort of ironic that the fuel in the reactor, of course, is protected by several more layers of protection than the spent fuel pool, which essentially has nothing other than an open pool of water to prevent that fuel from getting out the atmosphere.
And there's been significant contamination in the neighborhood, and now we learn that the tap water in Tokyo has high radiation and it's unfit for children and babies. We don't know the full extent of the radiation. The Japanese authorities have not been forthcoming, and the Tokyo Power Company has been accused in the Japanese media of routinely covering up accidents and poor maintenance reports. So it'll take a while for us to get the full damage assessment. Do you think, I know you were a consultant on the very prescient movie China Syndrome, and I recall at the time when China Syndrome was coming out, the nuclear industry got people like George Will to write these articles condemning the film as ridiculous fiction and dangerous and irresponsible fear-mongering. And lo and behold, the Three Mile Island accident happened. So what accounts for the influence of the nuclear lobby in this country? Why have they've survived the Three Mile Island, they've survived Chernobyl, and, you know, it's difficult to know whether the nuclear renaissance will happen after this Japanese event. But let's face it, they seem to have, you know, more lives than a cat.
Well, they're very dedicated believers in that this is the way that the energy future of the country and this world should go. And, I think there's a fair amount of profit motive in there, too. They like to sell more nuclear plants. I read that China, for example, is the biggest potential customer right now, and they are in the process of constructing a number of nuclear plants there. I've heard numbers as high as 100, but I don't know. I haven't been involved in that area.
Well, just in closing, Dale Breidenbaugh, obviously it's been tough to walk out on a career. Do you have any regrets, or what are your regrets?
Well, I have some regrets in that I regret that the industry and the public didn't take it seriously enough some 35 years ago to actually embark upon a very extensive crash program of developing alternative energy supplies other than nuclear, you know, wind and solar and so on. I think that that's ultimately the way that our energy future is going to go, but we could have gotten there a lot sooner if we had taken more seriously the problems that were besetting the nuclear industry back in 1976 and that continue to this day.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Dale Breidenbaugh.
Okay, Ian. You're very welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Dale Breidenbaugh, who was one of the GE3. He, Gregory Miner, and Richard Hubbard were nuclear engineers for General Electric, who in 1975 blew the whistle on U.S. nuclear power plants. Dale Breidenbaugh and his colleagues resigned from their positions at General Electric and joined the anti-nuclear movement.
Let's now take a brief station break, and we'll be joined in the studio by the chief organizer of the Teamsters Union.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing, and I'm speaking with Jeff Farmer, who's the Director of Organizing for the Teamsters Union. And Jeff, you're here in town. There's a big rally next Saturday, March 26th. What's the message from this rally you hope to get to the American people?
Well, we're trying to express our solidarity first and foremost with the workers that are under attack in the Midwest, who are facing these incredible attacks from new Republican governors who want to strip workers of their collective bargaining rights, take away hard-fought benefits that they've won over the years. So solidarity is one key part of it. The second thing we want to do is just to express here in L.A. the fact that workers had the opportunity to come together to proactively fight for their rights, that we have a number of organizing campaigns here in Los Angeles, and it's a chance for workers in a blue state, if you will, to show that they stand in solidarity with workers in other states, but also are going to take matters into their own hands and be aggressive and build strong communities and coalitions. So under the banner of Our Communities, Our Jobs, we're going to be marching and rallying Saturday, March 26th.
And do you think the American people are falling for this obvious wedge that's being driven between private sector workers and public sector workers in terms of, you know, it's a kind of a race to the bottom. Just because the guys in the private sector have been screwed and lost their pensions and their benefits, they somehow are being encouraged to blame these public sector workers who have it too good. The whole thing is, to my mind, is completely backwards.
Exactly. And I think, you know, much to my delight, I really see workers not falling for this, that folks are I think these Republicans have gone too far, and that in a sense they've exposed themselves, that this is not about fixing a state budget deficit, but this is about fundamentally stripping workers of their rights. And I think that by the fact that these Republicans have overreached and gone too far, you know, the American people object to the notion of taking your basic rights, freedom of association, freedom of assembly, and stripping those away. So that's one point. I think the second idea here is that we've seen in the polling that the American people support the rights of these workers. They support collective bargaining. I think they see through this notion that, you know, workers in one sector are the problem, you know, versus the workers in another sector. I think what we need to do, it's up to us to demonstrate the fact that really all roads lead to Wall Street here. All roads lead to the bankers, the corporations, those who control this economy. And the fact is that others have pointed out there's plenty of money in this country that could be shared. But the fact is that it's been ripped off by the very wealthy, by the top 1-2%. And so we need to reverse things. And a starting point is for us to come together in coalitions with students, workers, trade unionists, non-union workers, community allies, and to say enough is enough, that all over the world, folks are fighting to have their voices heard. And now it's our turn here in L.A. And we need to build a powerful coalition that says no to these policies of dividing people and stripping them of their rights and taking all the money and running off. This country is too good. There's too much at stake here. And I think the message that we want to deliver is that enough is enough, and we're ready to fight back.
Again, I'm speaking with Jeff Fum, who's the director of organizing for the Teamsters Union. And clearly, there isn't a Labor Party here in the United States, as you have in other Western democracies, where unions have more direct political heft in the political process. And the unions have to rely on the Democratic Party, which is a broader coalition. And as you know, from the Clinton days, Clinton made an effort to woo Wall Street. And it's pretty clear that President Obama is also being kind to Wall Street. And one of the great paradoxes, to my mind, is that the president dropped the ball on the outrage about Wall Street that you've just expressed and somehow handed that to the Tea Party and let them run with it. Do you think that working Americans and unions like yours can recapture that lost ground?
I think this is a unique opportunity, and we better make the best of it. I think that what we've seen in Madison and Columbus and Indianapolis and these states is that workers are ready, willing, and able to fight back. And that the more they do, the more that it inspires everyone. So I see the fact that I think with what's been happening in these state capitals, tremendous momentum is being created. We intend to kind of carry that momentum through here in downtown LA on March 26th and have a massive march and rally. And then I'm excited to see the plans underway for a national day of action on April 4th, the anniversary of the assassination of Dr. King. Dr. King was organizing sanitation workers in Memphis when he was gunned down. And to have that day now be a national day where we can express our solidarity with one another, where we can say no to these corporate policies of ripping off the American public. I'm excited about that. This is not going to be easy. We don't have the votes in some of these states. We're going to lose on a number of these pieces of legislation. But I think the thing that's different is that our labor movement, I think, is significantly different today than it was even 4 weeks ago. And that there's this notion out there that we can fight back and that we must. And that this is really the, you know, kind of the deciding point. I think in the first couple of years of the Obama administration, we were very hopeful that we would win certain gains. None of that has happened. So we need to take matters into our own hands. We need to be a voice for real action. And so I think that these next several weeks and several months are going to be really very, very important. I go back to this notion that no one's going to do it for us. We have to do it for ourselves. We have to, you know, build coalitions, and we have to fight back. And I think when we do that, we can be successful. I'm excited as a director of organizing for the Teamsters Union that even in these tough economic times, that workers are organizing and winning representation despite all the obstacles. We just won an election this past year for 8,000 ramp workers, for fleet service workers at Continental Airlines. Those workers had attempted on numerous occasions in the past to organize and win a union, and they weren't successful. We went in there and we said, let's put together a real plan. We did it. Now they're sitting down at the bargaining table, you know, across the table from management. So I think that, you know, we need to, just like an injury to one is an injury to all, as we've seen with what's going on in Madison, I think it's also important to think of a victory for one is a victory for all, so that when we do have success, that we share that success. But I think at this point, it really is about building a national movement where we express our outrage.
It seemed to me that given that public employee unions are being vilified, that it behooves the union movement to really deal with something that I think is a genuine concern on the part of a lot of taxpayers. And they feel that if you're being paid with taxpayer dollars and your dues go to fund the Democratic Party and you help elect people at the local, state, and federal level, that those politicians that you've funded, when you sit down to bargain with your union, are not going to be particularly forceful. So there is definitely a perception out there that the Democratic Party, having gotten a lot of people elected via union money, are not necessarily going to hold the feet to the fire of the union members when it comes to public employee sector bargaining.
Well, I think, first of all, I would say that, you know, workers are also first and foremost citizens, and that they had the same concerns as taxpayers and as citizens as anyone else. I do think that what public sector bargaining allows workers is a chance to have their voice heard, in that so much of what the labor movement is about in the public sector is giving an opportunity for those workers to have a voice in what they say and do in the job. So it's not just about wages and benefits. It's about creating an atmosphere where, you know, their input is honored and their ideas are taken into consideration. Clearly, there's got to be a serious and responsible bargaining on both sides. Every single agreement that's reached is reached by both sides. And, you know, we're not expecting, when we represent workers in the public sector, we're not expecting to take the employer to the cleaners. I mean, we want to get a decent contract for our members. We want them to feel like they're getting compensated fairly for the work that they do. Now, there can be some abuses, but again, our members are our taxpayers as well, and I think it's important that, you know, those negotiations take place in an atmosphere of mutual respect and what have you. So I do think that an important role that unions play in the public sector, though, is to provide those workers with a voice. That, I think, benefits everybody.
Jeff Farmer, again, the director of organizing for the Teamsters Union. It seems to me, though, when you look at what happened on Wall Street, you can make a real case that there's a crisis in American capitalism, that Wall Street's about extracting wealth, not creating wealth, extracting wealth for the few, not creating wealth for the many. And I'm wondering who's going to begin a debate, because the unions are often dismissed as being on one side of the table. The argument should be about the American family and the American community and how Main Street is getting hosed here. I'm waiting for somebody to talk about the broader issues of economic fairness and to counteract what seems to be an amazing piece of fraud, that the Tea Party came across as a real American insurrection. But if you look at the legislative agenda of all the Tea Party members in the Congress and their governors that have just been elected, their first and only legislative priorities are tax breaks for the big corporations and for the wealthy. I mean, it looks as like a giant fraud has taken place. So, in the face of this fraud, why not a real movement, a real Tea Party?
Well, exactly. I think that's exactly what we need. And it is the very richest in this country, the corporations that have essentially taken the resources of an entire nation and run off with them. Our general president, Teamster President Jim Hoffa, has talked about an economic pledge of allegiance, if you will, that would say to these corporations to keep the jobs in this country, to increase the manufacturing base here, questioning this idea of using free trade agreements and tax breaks to take jobs and ship them overseas and extort obscene profits in the process. So I think you're absolutely right. I think on the level of patriotism, if you will, that our side is really the side on the side of the angels here. We're the ones that are fighting for and trying to defend the middle class from being put out of existence. I'm proud of the fact, for example, that just in the past several years, our union has organized over 30,000 workers in the school bus industry, folks who work for private sector school bus companies. And they provide an important service in our communities, but yet we're paid terribly and we're treated miserably. And by winning union representation, they were able to, they're in the process of bettering their lives. That needs to happen on a massive scale all across the country. So I think as we fight these defensive fights and take on this fraud, as you say, it is absolute fraud. Governor Scott Walker, one of the things hasn't been as well publicized as it should have, is one of his very first acts in office was not only to attack public sector unions, but was to give a massive tax break to the wealthy of the state of Wisconsin. So it all goes hand in hand. And I think that it is a combination of doing everything we can to expose this and to fight back defensively. But we also need to, even against all odds, to be offensive and to organize as best we can.
And it would seem, though, that I don't know whether our politics are so lost in partisan rancor that the truth doesn't matter anymore. Sometimes I worry about that. But the truth of the matter is that the healthiest economy in the globe today is the German economy.
Right.
And there's no question about that. And in Germany, union representatives are guaranteed a number of seats on the board of directors of all corporations. And that would indicate that capitalism works better when you have that kind of, not that adversarial relationship where one side just wants to grind the other side out of existence, which seems to be the way that American CEOs almost train when they go to Harvard and Wharton Business School. So is that an argument you can make in terms of, here's an example of where we have something quite different that works a lot better than what we have here?
I think it's a very effective argument. It's a very effective example that we can use. I've actually had the good fortune of spending some time meeting with workers' councils in Germany and seeing that system firsthand. It's very impressive. It also comes with the expectation that the national interest, the economic well-being of the entire nation is an important objective. And it seems to be the way we have the system set up in this country is that's not really the case. It's all about short-term, immediate profits and whatever it takes to support the bottom line. Well, sometimes that bottom line is apparently best enhanced by taking jobs and shipping them overseas or extracting maximum profits as opposed to, distributing and sharing the wealth and allowing workers to be partners in an overall economy. But one of the reasons I think it's so important for us to organize is that we need to, our numbers in the private sector, we represent 7% of the workers in the private sector today. We can't expect to be partners in any kind of economic system if we're so poorly represented. So I think that we need to increase the strength, the tenacity of our labor movement, and then demand the kinds of changes that exist or the kind of system that exists in some other countries.
Given that you just cited that statistic that unionized workers are down to only 7% of the private sector employment, there has to be some soul searching here because the numbers were never that bad. They've gone down gradually. There has to be a reason. It's not just, to my mind, the power of the big capitalists who've got the megaphone of the media, which they own. That's an obvious one. But there seems to be something terribly missing here in why working Americans are so often wooed by the Republican Party, the Reagan-Democrat syndrome, which Reagan was so successful at. What is it about American workers, that, unlike their counterparts in the rest of the world, that makes them susceptible to this idea that they can go it alone and that they don't need unions when the evidence is so manifest in the opposite direction?
Well, here's what I think. I think that American workers have not been given the chance to form and join unions, frankly. We have a system that gives workers those rights on paper. But in reality, day to day, I've seen every day from our experience what workers face when they attempt to organize and bargain collectively. And the fact is that the power of these corporations, the multi-billion dollar anti-union industry that's sprouted up in the last decade or two, everything is stacked against workers when they go out and organize and attempt to organize a union. But given a level playing field, given an opportunity to fairly and freely express for themselves, we see time and time again workers choosing to be represented by a union. We've been able, with some companies, to win essentially agreements with those companies for them to be neutral in the case of union organizing efforts. And when we see that neutrality in place, workers make a decision based on the facts, and they overwhelmingly choose to be represented by a union. Polling indicates that there would be millions and millions of American workers who would join a union tomorrow if they could join a union the same way that they join the NRA or the National Wildlife Federation, by signing a card and becoming a member. So I think, you know, the answer to the question is that there's these legal and structural impediments to organizing. There is a whole mythology, as you point out, that 24/7 propaganda against unions. So listen, I mean, I think it's really just a combination of many things. But the fact is that I think that workers will respond if they see a labor movement that is aggressively fighting on behalf of workers. And I think that's our task in the next months ahead. We need to take this momentum, this fight back spirit, if you will, coming out of the Midwest. And we need to take that and spread it across the country in public, private sectors, and really give people some hope and inspiration that it can be done, that you can fight back and win.
So the rally that you're helping organize this coming Saturday, March the 26th, in downtown Los Angeles, there's a perception that demonstrations are a thing of the past. But I guess maybe things in Wisconsin change a lot of people's mind, right?
I really think that's the case. I think that what we've seen coming out of Wisconsin and Columbus and Indianapolis has really given a lot of us kind of a fresh perspective that, you know, we need to demonstrate. We need to fight back. Being a citizen, being an activist is more than simply casting a ballot in some election. It's about being engaged. And sometimes that engagement needs to be militant. It needs to be demonstrative. It needs to be in the streets. And we need to get that message out there. Here's the other thing about rallying or demonstrating or whatever, is that my experience is that people remember it, that people are transformed by it. The notion that, you know, this whole slogan, this whole chant of whose streets are streets, that this is what democracy looks like. Those are important elements, that the experience of being part of something larger than yourself, that being part of a movement is inspiring. I think it inspired workers in the 30s. I think it inspired folks in the civil rights movement of the 60s, in the anti-war movements. But I think it is important that we're out there, that we're giving hope and inspiration. And that I know that as a young man, I was involved in anti-war demonstrations in the nation's capital. And I came back from those experiences transfixed. And it changed my life. I've been active in the labor movement and other movements for the rest of my life as a result. And I think that those demonstrations and rallies and marches, it's important. We need to show that we have important messages, that we have a way to convey those messages, and that we, as I say, we give hope and inspiration to those who participate. I think we're on the cusp of really building something here. And I think that March 26th in downtown LA is going to be an extraordinary day. It's labor folks, it's non-union workers, it's academics, it's students, it's clergy, community activists, environmentalists. It's going to be a hell of a day in downtown LA on March 26th.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Jeff Farmer.
Thank you.
And again, Jeff Farmer is the director of organizing for the Teamsters Union. He is here in Los Angeles helping organize a rally that will take place on Saturday, March the 26th, beginning at 10 a.m. at the Convention Center in downtown Los Angeles. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nazada. Our theme music is by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'm also writing a daily blog. You can go to ianmasters.com and click on blog. You may leave comments, and I'd love to hear from you. I'll be back on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.